Well, let's pull ourselves together here. We've had two very useful days of discussion, and I would like us to simply carry on with that discussion today for as long as we can. I'm glad to see you all here. Dolly Garza has joined us today, and Dolly is chairman of the 1991 committee of the Village Corporation at Craig. And if I can summarize what we have talked about thus far, we considered the ways in which the corporations might be protected from being taken over. Our assumption was that the land and other assets, but the land especially, would be left in the hands of the corporations. So the problem then that we addressed was, how do we make sure those corporations aren't taken over after 1991? And there were a number of suggestions made. We talked about the possibility of placing corporate land in the land bank. That was a suggestion that many felt had drawbacks. Then we decided to look at what would happen if the land were transferred from corporate ownership to ownership in some other entity. And we were looking at, and I'd like to lump them together again, we were looking at non-profit corporations, at cooperatives, both state-authorized entities, and we were going to look at IRAs, not with a view to opening up the whole discussion about sovereignty. That's something that comes at the roundtable in December, but simply to look at IRAs as receptacles, so to speak, convenient vehicles for holding native ancestral land. I thought that today I would just go back to the discussion about the land bank for a minute or two to make sure that we have exhausted that. Then we would come again, if you don't mind, to look at the nonprofits, the co-ops, and the IRAs. I thought that on the nonprofits and the co-ops, Dan Fessler was good enough to discuss those at length yesterday. I thought I would ask Elizabeth if she had anything to add, and Monroe Price if he had anything to add. And on the IRAs, I thought I would ask Ralph Johnson to discuss those, and then others to join in that discussion. Then I thought we could go back to the question, well, if these are good places to put the land, how do we get it there? And I thought we would go back, if you don't mind, to the question of complying with Alaskan state corporate law for getting it from here to there, whether you're trying to get it to a cooperative, an IRA, or a non-profit. And then we thought also we would look at the question of solicitation of proxies, and we'd ask Elizabeth to talk about that since she's written the state law on the subject. And then I thought we would look at voting trusts. That is, if you don't put the land anywhere, can you put the shares somewhere so the shares can't be taken over? And then I thought we would conclude our discussion and our 3 days by returning to where Bart Garber started us off, that is, the whole question of native values and corporate values, or native values and Western values, however you want to put it, and just see if we can't draw back from the details and take a look at the philosophical underpinning of this whole business. So that's what I thought we would do today. I know some of you, or at least one or two of you, have to leave at noon, but I thought we'd carry on into the afternoon as well. There were some people who had been in the audience who had wanted a chance to speak as well, and when we reach that question of values at the end, perhaps we might invite some in the audience who've expressed a wish to speak to participate. So maybe we could go back to the land bank. I know this is covering the ground again, but this is pretty important ground, and from my point of view, it's worthwhile to emerge from this discussion with the principles clear in one's mind. David, you wanted to make one or two observations about the land bank.
First, maybe we mentioned it yesterday, but I think it's just worth noting that I know we discussed it among our several of us discussed it afterwards. That after the enactment of the Allotment Act, and I think it was within a period of 10 years after 1887, I could be a bit wrong.
You mean on the Dawes Act.
The Dawes Act, right, the 1887 General Allotment Act, which also, it's sort of the opposite of the land status under the Claims Act in a way, but there's some parallels. It restricted land from alienation and, of course, taxation and all the rest, for a period of 25 years. And what began to happen, the president was authorized to extend that period of trust for a longer period of time. And what began to happen rather shortly after the Dawes Act, really, was that the president began to extend that period of restriction. And it is curious, and one said eerie, that we are now talking about further restrictions and more permanent restrictions, long-term restrictions on the ANCSA lands. And that seems to come up in the context of what's called the land bank. And I was sort of tossing and turning, and I woke up this morning, and maybe this is this reflects on the quality of the idea. But it occurred to me that the land placed in the land bank is protected from taxation, and it's protected from judgments, and it's protected from adverse possession, and it's federally managed. And that begins to sound an awful lot like a reservation, functionally, anyway. Now, there's some differences, of course. The land in the land bank can be condemned under state law, and a reservation can't, and of course is not really, maybe it is, but it's not functionally, it's not legally, the word isn't used, it's not held in trust. But I just was reflecting on all that, and it's a bit curious that, you know, historically this has happened, something like this has happened before, and although the word is not has never been in favor in Alaska, I wonder if, when we're talking about the land bank, if we're really not talking about something like a reservation. And I don't know why that is, but I just thought I'd put that on the table.
Drew Hageman.
I must say, David, that in some recent discussions I've had with both with some native people in the Anchorage area, that notion of and they're reluctant to use the word reservation. But your dream this morning is more widely held than you think. That there appear to be a number of people who would welcome an Indian country kind of concern that would have much of the same kinds of characteristics. hopefully not some of the negative characteristics, but some of the same protection characteristics, and held in trust. And so I don't think that your summary is quite far off from at least some feelings of some fairly some people who've thought very carefully about that issue.
Can I ask a question of David, and then we'll go to Roland. Does that mean you want the floor? Under the General Allotment Act, the Dawes Act of 1887, Indian reservations were broken up. Individual Indians received allotments, land in fee, but they couldn't sell it for 20 years, or 25 years, was it?
25
years. And did you say that the president was authorized to extend the period of non-alienability of land under the Dawes Act? Is that what happened?
Well, that's my recollection, but if...
Either by the Dawes Act itself or subsequent...
Subsequent amendments.
Yeah. And you're saying that the land bank seems to be a way of simply postponing the... continuing the immunities or the protections under ANCSA.
Yeah, the protections under ANCSA aren't the same as the under the Dawes Act, because the land can be sold without secretarial consent and so forth. But some of the other restrictions are similar, prevention of taxation and so on.
But it's in a way like the shares were made inalienable under ANCSA, and now the protection, in a sense, is being moved over from the shares to the land under the land bank, or is that being too simple-minded?
Well, I'm not sure. Because the protections were are both on the land and on the stock, but they're different kinds of restrictions.
Yeah.
One might call them protections, and so they both had restrictions on them, land and stock, just different kinds.
Yeah. Rosita.
I'd just like to point out that even though there were these restrictions from taxation and alienation, it didn't mean that the secretary couldn't lease lands. And I think that's important to bring out, is that there were, reservations where, significant amounts of land were leased out. And even here in Alaska, and just having come back from Barrow and taking a look at development and a movement of population into Barrow, land becomes very significant. And one of the things that we're finding out is that there is, it looks like there is a significant or high percent of restricted lots that are being leased out, long-term leases, to non-natives.
Who's leasing them? I'm sorry.
Well, the leases have...
Whose land?
It's native land. Native individual allottees are leasing their lands to non-natives.
I see. Mm-hmm. Roland Shanks, and then Roland.
Well, just to kind of touch back on David's dream or nightmare, whichever it might be, actually some of the models that were used for the land bank weren't really reservation status at all, but some of them were, in fact, some of the agricultural taxation acts in the western states, like the Williamson Act in California and some others, which essentially some of the western states have passed to keep land in agricultural status by giving it a preferred tax position over years. And essentially that's even where the idea of like the renewable contract almost came from. So that's some of the background on the land bank. And I think there is one significant difference too, which I think people were aware of when they were putting together the legislation on the land bank, and that is that one of the primary differences between a reservation and the land bank is that the land bank really does operate essentially as a bank. I mean, it's just in the sense of a bank where if you have excess assets, you put your money in the bank and you draw out what you need when you need it and use it. The idea was that the corporation could essentially take, its excess lands, put it in a bank, and then draw it out as they needed it. leaving the corporate structure in place to simply make those decisions, how much land to put in the land bank and how much land to take out of the land bank and when to take it out. I don't think that the people who originally put together the land bank ever saw this as the panacea of protecting all the land. I don't think that anybody ever viewed it as a corporation would want to run down and take, 100% of its land holdings and throw it in the land bank. The idea was that it would be a repository for lands that had no immediate value or no immediate economic need in the village structure. Essentially, you take those excess lands or those lands that were particularly important to traditional uses, subsistence uses, and those kinds of things, and put them in the land bank. But I don't think it was ever intended to be a total answer to protecting all the land that a corporation might own. It was designed to serve, one small purpose. And I think that some of the major problems come in when you try and stretch it to this overall land protection kind of aspect and essentially distort it out of its original purpose, which was a way of protecting excess lands or lands that were important to the village in a non-economic sense. They were traditional lands or subsistence lands. So I think that's part of where we run into some of these problems is when we try and distort this purpose and make it broader than it really was when people were putting that thing together.
Yeah, Monroe Price and then Glenn Fenridge.
I'll defer.
Glenn?
One other thing, our lands, I said we have 1 million acres. Our lands are buffered either by the National Refuge and Fish and Wildlife. They have different regulations. That's been our problem. Is we go to an agency, say we wanted to, we looked at it and say we want to put some of our land into a land bank, and they crisscross, they bond together with Fish and Wildlife and Refuge, and they said, well, you got to go to them, you got to go to those, and we have no regulations, and that's what's been going on, Nobody knows, there is no regulations, I guess, and that's been the problem,
You can just get the bum shuffle.
Mm-hmm. Ralph, or did you want to speak to Monroe?
I think that's one of the reasons for the resolution.
Monroe Price.
Yeah, right.
Dealing with the deemed to be included language in the land bank. But all I wanted to say was that it seems to me that in one conceptual sense, and it may not be the only and the best conceptual sense, a reservation is merely a decision by the society that land ought to be reserved from the ordinary workings of the marketplace, and that it ought to be reserved from certain other lawmaking authorities. But take the marketplace as the first aspect of it. We have a lot of ways in our society for deciding that certain pieces of land at certain times ought to be held out from the ordinary workings of the marketplace. Indian reservations is one such concept. The Williamson Act is another. Reserve refuges, etc., are another. And I guess in that sense, this the land bank represents that. So I don't think that there's anything unique about it in that sense. The question is more to how do you determine, or who determines, and how do you determine how long you want to keep something out of the workings of the marketplace? And with what incentives to come back in or stay out, and under what terms?
Ralph Johnson?
Now, I think there are two basic concepts that need to be kept in mind. In New Zealand with the Maori in the 1887 Dawes Act, and more currently with the ANCSA, there's been an attempt by the governing powers to individualize native ownership. Now, if it is accepted by the native community and becomes a permanent change in the way of life, then that's fine. But what happened in New Zealand and what happened after 1887 Dawes Act and what I see happening here is that the native community does not wish to carry through on that total individualization effort. In some respects, yes, but in some respects, no. There's a clear intent by the community to wish to hold the land in either a permanent or semi-permanent way. In each of the cases in the past that that's occurred in New Zealand and with the 1887 Act, it has resulted in a major problem of fractionalization of ownership, because you have two concepts going head on against each other. One is the concept of maintaining a community, a communal way of life, and the other of individual ownership. And as long as that individual ownership is restricted, and it's going to descend from owner to owner to owner, it can't be conveyed away, then the fractionalization of ownership occurs. That creates all kinds of conflicts, makes it difficult, if not impossible, to manage the land and such. And so it seems to me that if this commission, or if the native community or whatever, is interested now in reestablishing some kind of a semi-permanent or permanent base, that care should be taken to assure that the fractionalization question does not start in again. I mean, that's a very serious kind of a problem that has not been foreseen before, and we should now, through our knowledge of history, be able to foresee it and either eliminate the individual ownership or buy it, one way or the other. But don't try and do two things at once.
Monroe Price, then Glenn Fredericks.
I want to ask Ralph this question. Under the Native Claims Settlement Act, there's an individualization of stock ownership and not an individualization of land ownership. That seems to me to be a fundamental difference from the Allotment Act. And the fractionalization that will occur will be a fractionalization of stock, unless the Native corporations themselves individualize land holdings, which they might. But as I wanted you to reflect on that distinction to see whether the fractionalization of stock is okay. That is, are there adverse social consequences to the fractionalization of stock, and how that relates to the Allotment Act?
I think you're right in that there is a significant difference. But in fact, if the stock is restricted, then I think there's a danger of the same thing happening, of the stock descending and being split and being split. So the stock ownership has no real meaning except as a membership in a group, but it doesn't have the market characteristics of ordinary stock. I think that's true. I'm not.
Well, but why is that? I just want to isolate and identify the harm and the social ill. In fractionalization of land, the problem is that it becomes, in some ways, unusable, undefinable. Even the community can't deal with the land. With the fractionalization of stock and the corporate ownership of land, or the communal ownership of land, if control is maintained, it just is you just have larger percentages of ownership in the community. Differing patterns of ownership.
Unequal ownership.
Possibly unequal.
Yeah,
I suppose you'll have unequal quantities of ownership. You'll also have ownership that will eventually bifurcate to a point where it'll be insignificant, where the participants won't have any incentive to participate as they would if they were involved in a government operation. If they were members of a tribe, they'd each have one vote, and they would participate in the tribe or village government, which would then manage the land. I think that it ends up being much the same thing if you restrict the alienability of the stock. It's different in the sense that we are more accustomed to the idea of splitting stock. We see stock being split. But right. Each stock at that point has monetary value, enough value so that it's worth splitting. But if we start splitting stock that has virtually no monetary value, then who keeps it? One reason I mention this is, if you look at the history of the Maori, they did the same thing. They had corporations with stock, and it becomes a terrible burden on the person who's trying to keep records of who owns the stock. I mean, it splits, and it isn't worth anything, and who wants to keep track of it? And the owners don't participate in the enterprise, and they don't have a one-person, one-vote kind of a relationship to the management of the land.
Well, I think that is a problem. And it's an important one, but it's a different one from the General Allotment Act problem. And it may be that if one conceives that as a significant problem, you would deal with it differently. You might prohibit, different percentage shares after a certain amount. Whatever.
Well, I think we've wrestled that one to the ground. Glenn and then Tony.
It's interesting, Ralph, that what you say of these other Indians or wherever they are, but it is happening in our villages. The elders especially are saying to us, how can we take this piece of ground once you give it to us with a deed, would put restrictions so that our kids won't sell it. It'll be theirs forever. And it's very interesting, the fractional. I can understand that because two kids don't say the same thing. One wants to sell it and the other wants to hold it. And we're seeing that now. We're going to see it more. But maybe there's a way of doing this. Maybe the corporations can put in and individually give each person some acreage that they could do as they wish, you know, something. But it's interesting because it's happening already.
Tony Strong and then Dolly Garza.
Thank you. We wrestled it to the ground, but let's wrestle it a little bit longer because of the kind of problem that Glenn has just articulated here. The analogy to allotments is a lot stronger than a lot of us perceive. When I worked for the American Indian Policy Review Commission, and one of the things that we looked at with the Policy Review Commission was the problem of allotments, and I also studied that problem a little bit more when I was working in the United States Senate. One of the problems that we identified with allotments, where fractionated ownership was taking place, is that there were cases where 1 acre of land was owned by 362 people. And there were times where, you know, how do you manage that? How do you determine if one of the people want to sell it, they've got to get 361 other people to agree to sell it. The result was that the people who were managing the land was the Department of Interior, and the way they managed the land was to lease it out. But when they got when they would lease it out for such things as grazing permits, the lessor had to pay a fee to the Department of Interior, which would be split among the 362 people. The lessor pays for 1 acre of land how much money per year, which is a piece of grazing land. Say if it's 100 acres of land, they pay maybe $100 per year. That Department of Interior has to write a royalty check or a lease check to each one of those 362 people. So they end up writing a 32-cent check for 362 different people once a year, and it costs them more to write the check than the check is worth. And if we don't deal with that problem in the terms of fractionated ownership of shares, if we're having one share being owned by 20 people and there's a distribution of $5 per share, the corporation's going to end up paying more for printing the check than the check is worth. And how many times do they have to go through that kind of difficulty? I think it's a real problem.
Yeah. I'm told that in some regional corporations, they now are down to persons who hold less than one share. And that's only 13 years after everybody started out with 100. Golly, and then Rosita, and then David.
I'm sorry I missed the first 2 days. It's unfortunate for me, but Shanseed Incorporated is one of the few village corporations who's made a shareholder home lot distribution under the ANILCA provisions. And we distributed 1.5 acres per 100 shares to our 317 shareholders. And one of the things that was debated probably for several years is whether or not the shareholder should be given fee simple title or whether or not they should be given, say, a 100-year lease. All of the lots are on waterfront property, and the purpose was to provide these shareholders the land to build a house in Southeast. A lot of the land is owned by Tagus National Forest, and there isn't a lot available for building. After wrestling it for several years, the board voted on a fee simple distribution, and we maintained first right of refusal. in repurchasing. That was the way we were going to attempt to maintain it within Native hands. And now the board is wrestling again with what are we going to do if half of our shareholders come in the first year and want to sell their land? Do we have the money to pay for it? And if not, how are we going to try and assure that it stays within Native hands? So it's a problem that's being faced now. I don't know if if we should have gone through the lease program, because the shareholders were very adamant that they felt that the land was theirs and they wanted it in their name to do with as they please.
Could I ask you a question, Dolly? You said that the corporation has the right of first refusal. Are those lots, once they are assigned in fee simple to shareholders, are they subject to property taxation if you happen to live within a city or a borough? Or
Under the ANILCA provision, they are not taxable for 10 years. None of the land is within the taxable boundaries, but that was one of the purposes of putting it under the ANILCA provision, was to avoid the taxation.
That's right, there's a 10-year provision. Rosita, and then David.
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to bring up one thing, and that is, you know, what's the primary use of the land to the people? And supposedly, allotments outside of communities were selected for hunting and fishing activities. And from my observations, I've found that when allotments are within hunting and fishing, primary hunting and fishing areas, that people tend to treat it as communal land, even though there is individuals have title to it. However, when you have a competing use for resource development, then very quickly the individual rights take primary consideration, and in that case, that's where I've seen individuals either lease their allotments. But the point is that if it's hunting and fishing areas, then people seem to come and go at in their usual patterns, irrespective of ownership.
David, did you want the floor?
Well, just briefly, one thing that Tony mentioned triggered something. You said that the effect of the Allotment Act was to put the increasingly the management of the allotments totally in the Department of the Interior. Of course, it's always there, but there's no, it was so fractionated that nobody else can make a decision about it. And that may well be the result of fractionating shares in a corporation, is that they're divided so into such numerous little pockets that management is more able to exercise complete control, or more complete control over the corporation. It didn't ever occur to me, but I was discussing this issue with an attorney once with regard to a corporation, and that was the conclusion, I guess, is that restricting stock would really strengthen the management of the corporation insofar as its ability to control voting on the shares.
Dolly, could I ask you a question? Did your corporation distribute those ANILCA lots by lottery, or how did you do that?
Yes, it was by lottery. There were two sites, one along a lake and one along an inlet that's close to Craig, and the shareholders had to decide which bank they wanted to be in, and then numbers were picked. It allowed for up to five lots to go together. Say you would pick one name, say my name, and if my family, my mom and my brothers and sister chose to, then that would mean that five lots would all go to my family, and it would be myself, my sister, my brother, my mom. And so there are many areas where there are five lots to one family.
And what did you give your own judgment on whether you thought that this was a having had the opportunity to think about it now, was a good idea or not so good or inevitable or?
I think it's one of the best things that our corporation has done, because we have provided something to our stock owners. If our corporation falls apart, at least they've got something. That's our idea. The shareholders are very happy with it. We've run into problems, but it seems like it's nothing that we can't work out.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Johnston.
I just wanted to, if I could, tie together what Dolly was talking about and what Ralph referred to. Although in this group we've talked and taken very seriously that the protection of native lands is important, and that there's a tremendous desire for the communal aspect. In addition, there is the desire that Dolly has referred to. In our region, it is a it's not only a minority, but it's much smaller than the 36%. But there is truly already, just as Ralph described, the tension between I want my land, and by that I mean what I myself own individually, and unlike what Dolly described as, where the board actually wrestled clearly with the tension between that and the communal aspect, some of the shareholders who want this are not wrestling with the tension there at all. It's as though there's no tension, and of course there is, because once it does pass into individual ownership, you have a totally different ball game. And also Dolly's referred to the fact that at least this meant that the corporation did accomplish something for the shareholders. And in those, again, I'll go back to the Bristol Bay region, but some of the villages in our region will not succeed in economic terms, and they are, if you like, in the posture of, okay, this is something we can do, and this is something we can achieve. And of course, that, again, exacerbates that tension between the desirability of the lands that go on and are protected, and the individual ownership. And I'm very happy you brought that up, because I think it's already there a little more than we had sort of admitted in the first 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Monroe Price?
Well, along these lines, I'd like to ask this question. Let's assume that you could take all the subsurface properties of a corporation, or of all the corporations, of a corporation, and divided into something which this may not be the correct name, unit trust, in which there could be individual holdings, so that basically you took the subsurface and allotted it to individuals, so that there would be a new corporation called Bristol Bay Subsurface Trust. And every shareholder got 100 shares of stock in it and could do whatever they wanted to with it. They could sell it or they could keep it. Are there the same social, moral, and other concerns with respect to that as there would be with respect to land?
Tom? Yes, are there, Elizabeth?
I think until every village is comfortable with the strength or weakness of 14F. I mean, tell me, Rosemary, if I'm speaking out of turn here, I would think they would be very concerned with who owned and had control of the subsurface.
Well, all right. Let's say subsurface not under village lands, which may not affect you very seriously, but it does other corporations.
Yeah, Bristol Bay and Chalista are two. It's right. A moot point.
Bart?
Yeah, Bart is the native values paper on this.
Well, no, I really can't say that, because I just point out that there is a conflict here, and I acknowledge that there are individual interests and communal. The problem is finding a balance rather than just saying pick one or the other. See, I'm an attorney, I'm a corporate attorney, I admire the administrative capabilities of corporation, but then again I realize the destructiveness. In one part that you're talking about right now, and this was the thing that I wanted to address, the idea those lands that aren't on village. Well, there's only half of the regional corporations that are in that posture. Most of the others, not just Bristol Bay and Chalista, don't have separate estates. And I guess maybe that might be alleviated at some point if there's an ability to switch estates at some time if the village corporations get into a position, a bargaining position, and the regions have the knowledge that they have the faith to be able to do that. So that might be able to be done. But otherwise, you know, where in my corporation, you know, you've got a situation where a region is telling you that that they can do what they want with the subsurface. Doesn't...
Yeah, but I was asking it in the, to determine what it is that that is deemed to be important in terms of the community's control of resources and its development of resources. Is that a land-related concern? Is it a developmental concern? If you could, and I'm prepared for the purposes of my hypothetical to take out the subsurface under village lands because it just allows me to ask the question in a sharper way. And that is, are there concerns, non-legal but moral, native value oriented, in separating out subsurface assets and having those be allotted, as it were, where there is no conflict with village corporations, et cetera? And where there's no conflict with subsistence.
Now, that's a hypothetical that's hard to imagine. I mean,
well, it isn't. Why is it hard to imagine?
I guess what you're talking about, is there any part of the psyche, and Rosita, you might want to talk about this also, that says that that we can split between development and the other side. And
well, let's say that let's say Bristol Bay has made a lot of money in real estate in Anchorage. Let's make it developed lands in urban areas of the state. And if you value the assets of the corporation, 20% of the value existed in these developed opportunities. Should the region or the village be able to separate that out, and I think Glenn mentioned this earlier, into a separate corporation, which is allotted. That is to say, the stock in that corporation is unrestricted.
I understand.
Would anybody have any qualms about that? Is there something to worry about in an instance in which you take assets of the corporation that have no subsistence related value or land related value?
Yes,
and spin them out. You could have objections on the grounds this is the economic heart of the region or the village or whatever, but so that's really what I'm saying.
Whether the communal instinct goes over to pure economic concerns, I don't know. I mean, that's going to have to be answered in each area. In the area that you and I are more familiar with, the number of at-large shareholders kind of tends to push the answer into the area of yes, that they are willing to go ahead and allot them individually. I don't think that even a community, a smaller one like that I come from, is adamantly opposed to economic development. That's one of the major purposes of the Act. I mean, yes, there was the concern that we wanted to get our land, but there was just as much comment in the legislative history that said we want to get jobs because our people are poor and nothing's going on, just like Chris said. I think that you're going to have a tougher road to hoe in areas where there are stronger interests to one side to go ahead and continue the communal economic aspect also. But I don't know. You know, there's that possibility. We have a way of looking at it within the regions to see who is at large, who is a village shareholder, to see who has that a little bit more of at stake. But other than that, I can't talk for anyone. Yeah.
Rosemarie Maher, you wanted to speak.
Yes. Selected a lot of land away from the villages for purposes of resources, and I think what you're suggesting would be unacceptable because, excuse me, the main reason the selections were made was for the resources to provide jobs for the shareholders, and it's all related to the shareholders. Also, all the regional corporation shareholders that live in the villages are both shareholders of the village and the region, and I think it would be unwise to separate that out, even if the land was away from the village. Because if you're on a regional corporation level, you're still dealing with the same shareholders. The main reason was for economics for the villages and the region. The shareholders needed jobs. We have a project up in the Eagle Country up there that spent a lot of money on because we felt it would provide shareholders with jobs. So I think it's related.